Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and when I tried to steal $200 million from Warner Brothers, they called it one of the biggest heists of all time. But when Todd Phillips, Lady Gaga, and Joaquin Phoenix did it, they called it Joker Folie à deux. Joining me today is Devinder Hardawar.
Just what everybody wanted, a remake of the Seinfeld finale starring the Joker.
And Jeff Cannata.
How do you make a Joker musical and not use Steve Miller Band? It's sitting right there. It's the pompatus of love.
Some people call me Maurice. Sorry, go ahead.
Those are vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing the newest movie in the DC universe, such as it is.
Is it? I don't think this exists in a DC universe. This doesn't exist in a DC universe.
It barely exists in our universe. The movie is called Joker Folie à deux. It is the sequel to the hit movie Joker that made about $1 billion when it came out in 2019 and was nominated for, I think, 10 Oscars. Of course, a movie that you'd want to make a sequel out of, you know, and spend hundreds of millions of dollars.
10 Oscars. A true dark time for America.
11 nominations, actually, and including it won Best Actor for Joaquin Phoenix and Best Original Score that year. So
I remember that Joker score, that theme of the Joker.
The classic
Joker motif.
I'm a Joker.
It goes something like this.
I'm a smoker.
You know.
That was my pulse during the movie, actually.
That's me imitating the score of Joker for you guys. Anyway, welcome to the Filmcast. Of course, we got some what we've been watching for you today, some weekly plugs, and a couple of announcements right at the top that I want to share with you guys. First of all, there is a movie that's out on Netflix this week called It's What's Inside. At the Sundance Film Festival in January of 2024, I watched 28 movies. And out of all of them, It's What's Inside was my favorite film. You should totally check it out. We are going to be discussing that movie on this week's After Dark. So if you want to hear an in-depth review of It's What's Inside on Netflix, be sure to be a subscriber at patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can sign up for ad-free episodes and exclusive After Darks. But whether or not you join us for that at patreon.com/filmpodcast, you should watch the movie because it's really freaking good, in my opinion. So anyway, It's What's Inside. That will be this week's After Dark. I wanted to, you know, we got a few reactions to our Megalopolis review last week, and I thought let's just touch on one of them here. This one comes in from Ryan in San Diego. Ryan writes in to /filmcast@gmail.com. I'd like to note that my theater didn't have the live interactive element. I'm gonna pause here for a moment and say, for those who don't know, there is a live participant element in
this. Isn't this only in the ultimate experience?
Yes. IMAX
experience. If you're booking tickets, which you should do now, because I don't think you'll have an opportunity to do so for much longer, you have to book tickets for the Megalopolis Ultimate Experience. That gives you a live interactive element. We will probably discuss what that element is during the course of this conversation we're about to have. But you know, as FYI, I think the movie is really hard to spoil because it's really out there. Anyway, Ryan says, I don't understand the buzz about it at all. Anyone that has been to a live screening of the Rocky Horror Picture Show has experienced real people interacting with the screen in a more enjoyable way. If drunk college kids can do it, it's not unique or groundbreaking, end quote.
I think that's a decent point. Although that was not intended when the Rocky Horror Picture Show was made.
That's right. This is a thing that's in Megalopolis. It is designed for a person on screen to be interacting with somebody in the audience. And I honestly wish that, like, in the movie Megalopolis, the Ultimate Experience, it happens for, I'm going to say, 30 seconds?
Duh, not even.
Not even?
I completely missed where it happened. Yeah.
And I kind of wish he had taken it a little further. You know, like, it could have been, it feels like such a kind of afterthought in its current execution, right? As opposed to, like, if they did something more like, oh, there's, like, 5 moments in the movie where it happens, you know, like then it would
Didn't we discuss what his original concept was,
which
was that it was going to be this dynamic who knows what the question's going to be. Any night right. you show up, there might be a completely different question.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so watered down, you know, from yeah. whatever the original vision was. But even within the constraints of what they had to work with right now, which is just an actor goes up or somebody from the audience goes up at some point, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like they could have done more with that. But, you know, hey, I think there were a lot of things that were envisioned that didn't actually end up happening. So, but yeah, the other thought that occurs to me reading this email is, and listening to you talk about it, Jeff, last week about how, like, you know, there's a live participant element in things all the time that people go to watch. It's called live theater.
Yeah.
I kind of in my head canon have in my mind that like Francis Ford Coppola hasn't been exposed to society for the last 30 years.
He's like, been sitting in a room drinking
his,
wine.
He's in his vineyards.
Success, yeah, his yeah. wealth and success have insulated him so much so that the idea, you know, in the movie Megalopolis, which is about this dream city that the main character, Caesar Catalina, wants to build out of a substance called Megalon, which he won the Nobel Prize for discovering. He
yep. We should have talked about that more in the review.
One of the things that he ends up achieving is like the city has these walkways, right? That like move you along. And a lot of people, including I think Devendra on the podcast, said that's literally just what we have at the airport right now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me, maybe Francis Ford Coppola hasn't been to an airport in 30 years.
Maybe. Right? Like, it also occurs to me yeah. that is sort of like a Los Angeles area person's view of like what a walkable city actually is. Like not yeah. actually walking, yeah. but if this were Los Angeles, right, Jeff? Like yeah. you need yeah. those moving walkways to sure. move between neighborhoods.
Yeah. yeah. You that's wouldn't actually...
Called, that's just called a foot car.
yeah, you wouldn't... Like New York City is not only already walkable as a city, but it also has public transit.
Yeah.
So it's very odd that like the whole Megalopolis or a huge part of Megalopolis hinges on these walkways that can take you to wherever you want. But I'm like, maybe yeah. the guy has just flown private for the last 30 years, right?
It's probably
so
true.
So he doesn't need to go to the airport and he hasn't seen the walkways.
He has private label teleportation technology. Like, well, yeah, no, he's
the thing that would be revealed to him if he had gone to the airport as somebody who lives, my main airport is one of, I think it's the second largest in the country, the Denver International Airport.
Yeah, next to mine. Yeah.
It's replete with moving walkways. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it is not a salve for what ails us. It is not a solution to the problem. You know why? Nobody understands that they are moving walkways.
Walkways.
They're not moving carry yo ass ways.
You got to be a little more vocal when you're going down. You got to sound like you're a train coming yeah. down the walkway, Jeff. And it's like, move it. if you're in the way while I'm walking.
This thing. You're gonna get trained. I do. I am obnoxious, as you might expect. But this notion that Americans think that, oh, there's a thing moving underneath my feet, be it stairs or walkway. And so the assignment now is to stand in the middle of this contraption mm-hmm. and just wait it out. Just wait to see where I end up, rather than what the Europeans do and what any civilized, decent person would do, which is, if you can't keep moving, stand to the side so that people who want to keep moving can move by you.
That's what he got the Nobel Prize for, Jeff, is fixing that problem for Americans.
Yeah.
Can like, Megalon, that doesn't matter. It just it zips you to where you need to go.
Can Megalon fix that in some way, please?
I like how the film cast is just gradually over time becoming Jeff's old man rants at society. that's really
you
all.
You can't tell me that doesn't annoy you.
That's really its final form. look, yeah, yes, it does annoy me, Jeff, but
you have the decency not to rant about it.
Well, I think it's more like I think there should be instructions. You know, like no one communicated.
There are usually instructions. There's a little sign. Walk.
Yeah.
Yes.
Walk on the left.
Sometimes
want to be on the right. Yeah.
Can I tell you what those instructions are, David? It's called society. That's what those instructions are. It's called think about someone other than yourself for 1 second.
Oh, Jeff, I have sad bad news for you about society.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Jeff, because I recently had a chance to experience society in its full bloom at a concert I went to this week. So Hans Zimmer has been doing a tour. nice, around the country. Yeah. Hans Zimmer Live is what it's called. And he recently showed up at Seattle at our main arena, which is called Climate Pledge Arena. Jeff, it's where we go watch the Seattle Storm WNBA game. And you have to understand, like, for me, Hans Zimmer is kind of like a godlike sort of creature. Like, I have been, you know, I have purchased Hans Zimmer CDs from Circuit City and listened to them countless times on my Discman and like my in-car CD player, right? Like,
you must be excited about that new Dragon Age 4 theme song, Dave. Hans Zimmer and Lauren Balfe together.
Yeah. So like I'm of the generation where I need to fast forward on my CD player to get to the part of the song that I'm really into. Right? Cause the tracks on the soundtrack albums are like 15 minutes long, right?
Yeah.
So
like enough of your whining, Lisa Gerrard. Get me to the battle theme.
Yeah, get me Gladiator. To the battle theme. So anyway, I went to see the Hans Zimmer concert. I have to say, like me and a bunch of like my friends locally were interested in going to see the Hans Zimmer concert. And many of my friends didn't, in fact, most of my friends did not go because the ticket prices were so extortionate in Seattle area. And here's the thing. When you look at other places that Hans Zimmer is going, it's like very reasonable, like between $50 and $150 for tickets. Right. Let me tell you guys, in Seattle, $450.
Woof.
For Hans Zimmer, you know, they know the target audience.
I'm looking at the seating chart and we're like, okay, like this has got to be like scalpers have bought up most of these things. Cause there's no way the entire Climate Pledge Arena is going to be full of people who are into Hans Zimmer music.
Yeah,
because there's only two tickets available here, $400 each. So I literally didn't buy a ticket until the day of the concert, and I'm like, they've got to come down in price at some point. They got to come down in price, and so I kept waiting, and basically like one or two would pop up like with a decent deal, but like in general, they did not decline in price. Someone even tried to sell their ticket for $1,000.
Wow,
which is like wow, that's really high. Anyway. Eventually, I panic bought a obstructed view seat for like $150, which is like the cheapest that I saw. Yeah.
And then you just see Hans Zimmer at the concert. You're there to hear him.
Okay, well, here's what ended up happening is I show up at the concert and I will say I had a blast. Like I was moved. There were tears because it's like these are music cues that I have been listening to for like 20 years. Like,
you're shouting from the audience, do Interstellar. Interstellar.
What were you going to say, Jeff?
I said, the good news is no one could see you crying because you were behind that pillar.
Yeah, behind the pillar, yeah.
What was great was I chose a seat that was behind the mixer area. So theoretically, like that. But here's the thing, the seat I chose actually. No one was blocking. Like there was no obstructive view. Not only that, it was actually a better view than floor people because like it was elevated. So it was actually pretty good.
As somebody who is in the, you know, was at one time for many years a ticket seller and was in the ticket seller union, I will tell you the term obstructed view is applied very liberally.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So anyway, I got lucky with the seat. However, what I was unlucky was the people sitting around me who were, I'm just going to say, assholes. They were not good people. And here's the thing.
Sorry.
The Hans Zimmer concert occupies a very weird place in like the concert scene. Because what he's done is he's taken a lot of his like famous tracks and tried to kind of zhuzh him up a bit with like rock elements, right? So it's like heavy emphasis on electric guitar, heavy emphasis on electric cello, like heavy emphasis on like percussion, like making all these things like really dynamic and loud. And on the, you know, that can be engaging, but also like it's not really why I go in for Hans Zimmer. Like I'm not, you know, that's not the primary reason. I want to listen to, you know, the fullness of the orchestral nature of many of these tracks. So I think some people who are assholes don't know how to conduct themselves.
What were they doing?
Well, they're just talking really loudly at full volume. And if you're going to like a Pixies concert, that's fine. Like, cause it's so overwhelmingly loud, But this is like, there's some things that are like so quiet that are like, you really need to strain to hear. Like when he opens the act, it's like a very subtle, like Dune track. And you need, it's like very subtle, very sublime. And there's people behind me just talking in full volume. Like I can, it's like, I'm trying to enjoy the music. So literally what I ended up doing, you'll appreciate this. I was sitting in the obstructed view section and there was a seat, a set of seats near me that were completely obstructed view. Like a camera person was in front of you could not see the stage at all. During the intermission, got up, moved to the completely obstructed view section where I could listen to my Hans Zimmer in peace. I couldn't see the stage basically at all.
You're like a corner of the stadium at this point.
Yeah, I don't hear the reverberations. About, like, the visuals are fine, whatever. They're cool. Yeah. They're cool visuals. There's no footage from the movies because he doesn't have any rights. So instead of there's like when he's doing Gladiator, there's like vague Gladiator Roman images projected on screen, but there's no footage from movies. And I got to enjoy my Hans Zimmer in peace, and that was a wonderful experience. So anyway,
that's cool.
This is my my thing is don't talk at full volume during what is primarily an orchestral concert.
Imagine like, you would not do that at a symphony,
you know? So like don't do it at the Hans Zimmer concert.
I'm not even sure I'm on board with you doing it at the Pixies show.
Or, yeah, fair. You
know? People do it.
The thing is, like, it's so loud, like it's hard for you to interfere with other people's experience. This was not that loud. It was not like overwhelmingly loud, is what I have to say.
Yeah. My question is, does Hans Zimmer need to be doing this?
He seems
like a busy man that has a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, isn't Gladiator 2 coming out? I think he just loves performing.
I'm sure.
He just loves doing it.
You get to hear
live.
Your own stuff like reverberated in a giant room, and then the audience is there enjoying it too. That must be electric for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he does do these things in between the tracks where he, like, does this patter, right? This audience patter. And, you know, he said something he said during the concert. He said, you know, after doing it for all these years, I still don't feel like I've really gotten it. And I thought that was profound.
These are all terrible. All right, everybody, have a great time.
yeah, I mean, he still has, like, insecurities and stuff like that. But anyway, it was very special. Like, I got to hear the Gladiator score. Lisa Gerrard was there, which is amazing. Interstellar, Inception, Lion King. These are all, like, medleys, right? So, and they're all, like, the best parts of the track. You know, like, he put all the most memorable themes into, like, one 10-minute track.
Were there any good deep cuts, Dave? Because I know sometimes we share live Hans Zimmer tracks, and there's like a version of like a Mission Impossible 2 theme or song that is very good. I hear it quite often.
Yeah. Does it go deep? First of all, I'll just say the entire arena. I don't know if I made this clear. Mm-hmm. The entire arena was basically sold out. So I'm like,
wow.
I guess he really high school David Chen could not have conceived that this guy who I had to buy the CDs of in the Circuit City, like in the place where no one visits. You know, in the Circuit City, he is now popular enough he can sell at an arena show. Like, he has enough name recognition, he can sell at an arena show. Okay.
Yep.
So, the deepest cut in the whole night was Dark Phoenix, the soundtrack to Dark Phoenix. So, he said, he did a medley of Dark Phoenix and Dunkirk, and he said, sometimes you make a movie and it doesn't turn out very good. but I still like the music from it, and so we're gonna play you the Dark Phoenix track. He in general tried to not say what the movie was from, or what track the movie was from. So
none of you have seen this movie, but here's a song.
That's right. That's basically what it was. But yeah, that was the deepest cut was Dark Phoenix. But
that's impressive, actually.
Otherwise, it was largely like the hits. Like I saw him live at Las Vegas before, and he played Lion King then as well, and you know, Gladiator then as well. So he knows which side his bread is buttered on. But anyway, if you are a fan of Hans Zimmer from like 20, 30 years going, you will enjoy going to the Hans Zimmer live concert, assuming you don't have assholes sitting around you talking.
They need to like produce some of these for like VR and also for like a really nice surround sound mix. Mm-hmm. Like just there's so many things they could be doing with these performances.
Yeah. Hearing the Wonder Woman suite with the that was very cool as well. Okay. Anyway, Hans Zimmer live. Just wanted to share with you and Devendra Hardwar. We've obviously bonded over our love of soundtracks, movie soundtrack scores in the past.
Yeah.
So, would recommend it. And also, if you're not in Seattle, it's actually reasonably priced. But for some reason, I think because, like, you know, everyone in Seattle wanted to go see this concert. So, like,
it's also all tech people. I'm sure if you look at, like, Silicon Valley area prices too, like, it would be probably insane.
Yeah. And also, Seattle's a very big movie town. Like, people love movies. Like, the Seattle International Film Festival is often, like, sold out of screenings and stuff. So, anyway, would recommend Hans Zimmer Live. He's touring the country right now. Check it out. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with what we've been watching right after this. All right, folks, it's time to get to what we've been watching this week. I want to talk about a movie that's going to be out in theaters this weekend. It's called The Apprentice. This is, by the way, a movie I attempted to advocate for a main review of and was, you know, usually, like, Devendra will shoot it down and Jeff will be like, oh, maybe. This is the one where both of you instantly were like, I have absolutely no interest in this film.
I will probably end up watching it at some point, but
I probably will too.
Yeah. But, ugh.
I'll read the plot summary here. This is from Rotten Tomatoes, the plot summary. A young Donald Trump, played by Sebastian Stan, eager to make his name as a hungry second son of a wealthy family in 1970s New York, comes under the spell of Roy Cohn, played by Jeremy Strong, the cutthroat attorney who would help create the Donald Trump we know today. End quote. So The Apprentice, I actually kind of like this movie. I, in general, don't like biopics. Mm-hmm. I think I find them to be quite tedious and formulaic. But what I like when biopics do the following, I enjoy them more, which is they focus on one aspect of a person's life, right? It's like a very thin, narrow slice of this person's life. And in this case, what The Apprentice is about is like, hey, what impact did this guy, Roy Cohn, have on Donald Trump? And, you know, I'm sure Donald Trump's influences were much more diverse and varied than what we saw in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
But the movie's thesis is, what if Roy Cohn helped to create, in a hugely instrumental way, the Donald Trump that we know today, right? That's,
the thing I want to know about this movie, Dave, is how strong is Jeremy Strong in this movie? Because now, whenever he appears, he is doing something in every
project. Jeremy Strong, in my opinion, is awesome in this movie. Like, he makes a complete transformation of his physicality, his accent, the way he talks, like all that stuff. He is awesome, and it's unrecognizable from his performance in Succession, which is what a lot of people know him from. So I'm super impressed, and even just as an acting exercise, I think it's worth watching Jeremy Strong in The Apprentice. So for that alone, I think it's worth watching.
We were talking about like method acting. I feel like he's like one of the last remaining guys trying to do like, I'm all in. I'm going to be fully this character.
That's right.
Even if it sounds and looks ridiculous sometimes.
That's right. I will say, by comparison, Sebastian Stan, it's fascinating how he chose to approach this, because basically he changed virtually nothing. Like, it's just, he kind of has a little bit of a New York accent. But, like, we've seen so many Trump impressions and impersonators, and it is, I feel like I'm not exaggerating. Like, if you didn't know that he was playing Donald Trump, I don't know if you'd be able to say that that's what that was. Like,
oh, really?
It's so subtle. He's going in the complete opposite direction. He's like, rather than trying to imitate Trump's, like, mannerisms and accent and all that stuff and voice, vocal tonality, he's like, he spends most of the movie being like, I'm just going to be Sebastian Stan and like playing this character called Donald Trump, you know, in a Sebastian Stan kind of way. Now, towards the end of the movie, he does get more recognizably Trump. But like, for most of the movie, it's like, if you didn't know it was Donald Trump, I don't know if you'd be able to tell. Honestly, that's how subtle it is. But
I'd imagine he wanted to do like a Christian Bale and American Psycho type of thing, which was a riff on Tom Cruise, but also sort of on Trump too. So
I think that's right. I think that's right. It's very much like Wall Street kind of style. Like, it's very much like that kind of style of where it's kind of just like he's kind of a insecure, you know, a chip on his shoulder, overachieving, trying to be overachieving businessman and so on. That's not a knock against the movie. I actually think that's like a very reasonable choice, because I think if he's trying to like do the Alec Baldwin Donald Trump, like, it's too, that's all everyone would be talking about. Instead, he's like, what if I just took that out of the picture and you're not even thinking about that at all? And I think that's a very reasonable dramatic decision. But the core story of the movie, The Apprentice, it's like, I would argue, I'm not going to say how the plot plays out, but I would argue it's pretty timeless. And the fact that it's Trump and Roy Cohn in this story, like, you know, it's kind of like a Shakespearean drama, Greek tragedy kind of thing. And the fact that it's these two characters is kind of almost incidental. But like the core themes in the story, I was a fan of. So,
well, there was a lot of hay made about this coming out before the election.
And yes.
Evidently, Trump's people really didn't want it to come out. And
yeah, there's a huge legal battle.
Yes.
About releasing this movie, and there was a lot of doubts about whether the movie would ever be released.
Is there, I mean, do you have any insight as to like, oh, people need to see this before the election, or it will illuminate some aspect of this, you know, presidential candidate in some way, or is all of that overblown?
Yeah, I think if you are familiar, like there's very little in the movie that is not already out there. In fact, I don't think anything in the movie is not already out there. Like,
right.
Pretty much everything in the movie is publicly known. The most shocking stuff, I would say, deals with Donald Trump's relationship with his ex-wife, Ivana Trump. And if you know about how that relationship unfolded and some of the accusations that she made, that stuff is in the movie, and it's upsetting. But that's all. It's all publicly known. It's like out there, you know. It's out there. By the way, Ivana Trump is played by Maria Bakalova from Borat 2, mm-hmm. and I thought she was awesome in the movie as well. So anyway, to answer your question, Jeff, I was thinking about this too. Like, this is the movie they tried to like silence, right? This is the movie they tried to make sure wasn't released. And yes, there are some upsetting scenes with Donald Trump in them that like that depict things that we know he did, you know, yeah. And that are very, that cast him in a very negative light, but it's all publicly known stuff. And so I guess I would say, Jeff, in my opinion, it is overblown. Like the idea that they tried to stop this movie is like, okay, yes, there's some upsetting stuff in it, but it's not.
This
it's
isn't
not like,
the thing that's going to blow this thing wide open.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
We've had plenty of those.
I don't think anyone's going to. Yeah. I don't think it will.
Yeah.
This is not the thing where it's like, oh, if everyone sees this, it's going to change the whole outcome of the election. Yeah, you know, like, right. I don't think anyone is under that impression. And I certainly wasn't under it. Like, so little of the movie is surprising in any way at all. That's the thing. It's like, there is almost nothing. Pretty much nothing in the movie depicts Donald Trump in a way that you don't already imagine him to be. So,
yeah.
So
I think there was this, you know, they were casting this movie as some sort of like Roger Moore-esque scree. And it doesn't seem to me that that's what it is at all.
I think you mean Michael Moore. Is that right?
Roger Moore. Yes. Roger and me, Michael Moore. Pardon me.
That'd be a very different documentary.
Conflated.
Yeah. I think you mean Roger. Sean Connery.
You know how that old James Bond actor used to just make those political diatribe documentaries?
It is not like that, in my opinion. Yeah. It's just like a pretty well-told story of the relationship between these two guys. So anyway, I was a fan. Check it out. The Apprentice. It's going to be in theaters this weekend.
By the way, I prefer the Sean Connery.
Squeeze. That's what I said.
I trample your.
Yeah, you trample on my John Connery joke.
And then I took it.
I'm more of a George Lazenby kind of guy.
He only had one though, and it was the ending was such a downer.
Yeah. All right, Devinder Hardwar, hit us up with something you've been watching.
Yeah, I just want to talk about Interview with the Vampire once again. I have finished season 2 of the show. This is the AMC, you know, serialized version of the Anne Rice book. And it's incredible. Season 2 is fantastic. It's not only just very good as I thought the first season was, but I also think it's one of the best TV series ever made. Wow. So this is me talking to you two, not our listeners. I beseech you, I implore you, watch this show. The first season is on Netflix right now. It's created a showrun by Rollin Jones, who's a playwright, and basically in interviews he describes working on the show of just getting like a whole gaggle of playwriters together to do something cool and weird with the show. And here are the ways I can convince you guys to watch it. So it treats Interview with the Vampire like Shakespeare. Like the language of Anne Rice is in, I remember reading, you know, at least the first book in high school.
Yeah, I read the first book as well. Yeah.
The language of Anne Rice, her character dynamics, the way she describes things, it is in the show. And it's not just like, oh, this is a pop, you know, airport book, you know, a fun little, you know, fantasy thing with vampires. No. This is serious dramatic business with vampires, with a love story that I think is truly compelling and truly moving. So just the way it sort of almost even elevates the book is fantastic. And also, I was just thinking, think of what Peter Jackson did to Lord of the Rings with his movies. Those were already great books, had great language. They were very, like, they were towering in their own right. But what he did was translate them into a way that is really accessible and viewable and is a really compelling drama to be seen on screen. And that is what they have done with this show. And the tough thing is that it's been tough to watch because it was on AMC Plus. You had to subscribe to it. But now you've got the first season on Netflix. And I tell you guys, watch the first episode. The sheer amount of, like, drama and emotion and feeling that is in that first episode is more than what we see in entire seasons of the recent Star Wars or MCU shows. So, like, this is tremendous television. Everybody should be watching it. I'm so glad the first season is on Netflix right now. These two seasons basically cover the entire first book. They have talked about, like, it seems like AMC wants to keep doing this. So I'm so glad they're doing it. Like, it has a decent budget. It has tremendous writers, and it has a really just an incredible array of actors too, who really do this material justice. So this could have gone the way of, like, cheap fantasy TV, and it didn't, because they care too much. Like, they care too much to do a good job with these characters, with just the setting, just the costume design. Season two takes us to Paris, where there's that whole section of the story where they have the young girl vampire Claudia, who's played by a different actor in season two. But just that whole drama of it is fun, it's funny, it's sexy, it's romantic. It's like, I was in tears by the end of the second season, because of how they basically built up this relationship between Louis de Pontillac and Lestat. And I just want to say, like, it is just so heartening to see. Because I remember reading the first book in high school and being like, this is amazing stuff. But I looked around at, like, book reviews and stuff, and people were really putting down Anne Rice as just this sort of genre writer. We shouldn't really take her too seriously. So anyway, if you care about good TV, if you care about good writing, you should be watching Interview with the Vampire.
Interview with the Vampire, available on Netflix right now.
The first season, yes.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, Devendra, I have zero interest in this show, but you're just on the strength of your recommendation. Yeah.
The language, Jeff, the language.
I intend to watch this. In fact, I was planning to watch it the first part of the first season this week. Mm-hmm. And what I've been watching got in the way. But
I can see why. The show you're watching is a lot of fun too. Yeah,
I intend to watch this. Purely on your recommendation.
Me and many, many other critics, like, people are raving over the show. It's just,
I don't care about them, DaVinci. I care about you.
I want to see other people watching it. That's all.
All right. That's one thing DaVinci Hardor has been watching. Jeff Canada, what's one thing you've been watching this week?
Well, the show that got in the way for us, for my wife and I, because I thought my wife and I would both enjoy the Interview with the Vampire. I thought it might be a good show for us to watch together. But we turned on the Netflix, and I'm scrolling, looking for The Interview with the Vampire, which, let's be honest, is nowhere near the carousel anymore.
You can't scroll new shows on Netflix.
Well, you can't even scroll any. You can't scroll anything. You get what you get. You know, that's what Netflix's business model is. Here, take what you get, or search. You know, those are your two options. So as I was trying to fumble my way toward a search tab, my wife goes, "Oh, look, that new Kristen Bell show."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Oh yeah, I do want to check that out. It is called Nobody Wants This." She's like, "Let's watch just, like, one of those as a little, you know, aperitif before we get to the meaty, you know, hour long drama show you want to watch." And I said, "Sure." 6 episodes later, we're still watching Nobody Wants This. Which is a delight. I am very enamored with this show. This is Kristen Bell and Adam Brody. And you'll hear movie critics like us. You'll hear people who talk about the history of cinema. You'll hear people mention the word chemistry, on-screen chemistry. And it's kind of an elusive term. It's kind of nebulous. It's kind of hard to pin down. But, you know, people talk about the great on-screen romance, the great chemistry of Clark Gable and whoever. I don't know. I don't have great examples. But you know,
Billy Crystal and whoever's next to him. Yeah.
Sure. You hear about these incredible, like, they lit up the screen. Their smoldering passion.
Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman.
Exactly who I was going to say.
Yes.
Sure. Thank you for stealing it from my mouth.
Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman from Casablanca.
Anyway. Sure. Great one.
Bonnie and Clyde.
I will.
Yeah, okay, anyway.
I submit that Kristen Bell and Adam Brody have the most potent, undeniable, loin smoldering chemistry I have ever seen
loin
in anything.
Nope.
Okay.
It is hot, guys. Hot. And one of the early episodes, they have this first kiss that is like one of the great screen kisses of all time. Mm-hmm. And on the page, in the script, it is supposed to be the greatest kiss. And they talk about it in later episodes of like this incredible kiss that they had. And I can only imagine you've been given the assignment to have the greatest kiss ever. That's daunting. Let me tell you, Kristen Bell and Adam Brody pull it off. It is the pure magnetism. And these are people who are married to other people in real life. I've heard that Dax Shepard thought even that it was hot. And I got to concur. It's not something I usually point out in romantic comedies or romances or any film. That's not something I'm usually in tune with, is like how friggin' attracted to each other are these people. But my God, it is palpable in this show. And I think worth the price of admission. It's worth watching just to see two people friggin' hot for each other, and you can feel it. It's intense and amazing. It's an amazing thing. Like, I think Kristen Bell is doing a lot of the heavy lifting here. And she is awesome. Also, it's got a fun supporting cast. Justine, is it Lupi or?
I don't know if it's
she's from Succession.
Yes,
she played Willa in Succession. I liked her in Succession. Could not be farther afield from Willa. She is a completely different character. She plays Kristen Bell's sister, and she is delightful, very funny, great comedic timing. I thought she was kind of a revelation here in the sense of I'd had her, you know, the first time I'd ever seen her in anything was in Succession, and all those characters are so indelible. It's like I really, you know, pinned her as this kind of Willa, this sort of.
Kind of funny in Succession, though. Like, it's a very similar role of like commenting on the crazier people around you type of thing.
I guess, but she's so much more fun here, mm-hmm. and doesn't have the angsty burdens that that Willa does. Anyway, I really loved her. And guys, I'm burying the lead because Kristen Bell and Justine Lupi have in this show the greatest profession, the most noble calling.
This is how I know you don't listen to my recommendations, though, Jeff. So we did all this last week.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, buddy. Everything. Adam Brody, Kristen Bell, podcasting! Well, we all talked about it!
It's true that Devendra did mention this week, the show last
yes.
week.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right.
And you even commented on the podcasting, I think calling it the greatest profession.
You know, well, Jeff, you could have easily saved it by just saying, "Well, why do you think we watched it this week?"
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That's because the Devendra recommended it. I was trying to watch your other recommendation, dude.
Yep. Yep.
My God,
this is how it's how like, on point
it's like
I am.
Drinking from a fire hose with you.
Yeah, Jeff only has room in his head for one recommendation.
I'm focused on now. Let me tell you something. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, just to be clear, her job is podcasting.
She's a podcaster.
A relationship podcaster, too.
They're podcasters. And I feel like what has happened in the year of our Lord 2024 is that we, the three of us, are finally having the experience that lawyers, doctors, police officers, firefighters have had their whole lives, where great amounts of money and talent have been leveraged to convey to the world what it's like to be them, where they get to settle down at night and have so many different options. Which show shall we watch that dramatizes my life? Which of the myriad different facets of my glorious profession shall we enjoy tonight? That is where what we have achieved, my friends. That is where we are now, is that, there are numerous options on television of the different podcasters and their foibles, their day-to-day encounters, the aspects of their job. Are they accurate? God, no. God, no. But I'm sure that's exactly what lawyers, doctors, police officers, and firefighters have experienced for decades now. The tenuous connection to reality that is depicted in their professions. And I just think, finally, I can understand. And finally, we are in that place, my friends. And I think that's glorious.
Every podcaster wants to see a story about other podcasters trying to get a Spotify deal. That's what we all want.
I apologize that I did not clock that you had already recommended
it. It's okay. So that's how my recommendations work. I both recommend something directly and also hit the puck to where you will be in the future.
It's impressive.
With the assumption that you will also need to watch.
You want to throw the ball to where you're going.
To where the carousel is going, you see. Yeah.
I really liked the show a lot. I laughed a lot. I felt something deep within my groin. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
It's like it's an intense.
Kids listen to this podcast, Jeff.
Not anymore.
Listen, it's also a great appetizer for the sort of like loins on fire stuff you will see in Interview with the Vampire, because
really just love if we stopped using the word loins.
Well, it's great. It's great.
At least just literally for the rest of the episode.
Crotchular region. It's
fantastic. Fantastic. But you know what, Jeff? I do want to say, like, yes, Adam Brody is fantastic in this. I've thought that since The OC. And you know what? You know what is a good show to watch with your wife, Jeff? I'm going to put this out there. You guys should watch The OC. The OC was fantastic. And I'm sure you love all the people who live in Orange County. But oh my God, the drama of The OC. I once did a public screening at our college with a bunch of people just going to see a specific episode. People around me screaming and crying because somebody in The OC got in a car accident. That's how impactful that show was.
My wife loves that show, so
it's a fantastic show.
Yeah,
and Dave, if you're even mildly interested in Nobody Wants This, let me tell you, you know who's also in this?
Tim Simons.
One Stephen Tobolowsky.
Oh, yes, he does appear.
Yeah, plays Adam Brody's boss. So the hook with this is Da Vinci already mentioned it last week, but he's a rabbi.
Yeah,
he's a rabbi.
He's a rabbi, and she's not. A non-Jewish lady.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the show's come under fire recently, too, because I think a lot of, especially women Jewish critics are saying that it does kind of have a problem with how it presents Jewish women, because the perspective of the showrunner is somebody who was not Jewish and converted for her husband. So she has that direct experience. And maybe, I don't know, maybe stereotypes of Jewish women are kind of falling into there. From what I can tell, the show is a lot of fun, but those criticisms are out there.
Yeah, we had I recognize that, and I think it's probably valid. But man, as just kind of a silly romantic comedy with
fun,
really, really charged chemistry at the top of it, and some delightful jokes. I think the show's really pretty funny, and it's fun. It's great. Great half an hour comedy that you can binge through as we did. Nobody Wants This.
That's something else Jeff Cannata has been watching. Let's take a break for a sponsor and talk about more what we've been watching right after this. Let's talk about something else I've been watching this week. I had a chance to see Coralie Farjah's 2017 movie Revenge. This is a movie that is, I think, is Coralie's first movie, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
And this movie is a blast. So for those who don't know, Coralie Farjah is the writer-director of The Substance, which is out in theaters right now, still doing pretty well at the box office. It lost like a bunch of screens this week, but only dropped a tiny bit in terms of its box office take this weekend. Great word of mouth for that title, and it will eventually be available on Mubi. But before she made The Substance, she made this movie called Revenge in 2017. And this movie has an extremely simple, arguably silly plot. But you can see just from the poster, the box art, it's about a woman getting revenge. That's basically the plot of the movie. Devinder, you've seen this movie, right? Have you seen Revenge?
I did see Revenge. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
I think it is extremely well done. What I would point out about this movie is it's a really kind of pulpy kind of exploitation-esque thriller. Where, again, this woman gets revenge on people who I will not say what, because I don't want to spoil what happens in the movie. But what is really clear when you're watching this is, holy shit, this person is talented. Like, this is a movie that's emerging into the world fully formed, like some things that happen in The Substance. And it's basically, you can tell, like, when a person bursts onto the scene. This is like... when Brick came out, it's like, my gosh, this person has an amazing future ahead of them making movies if they're given the opportunity to. And they would then continue that in The Substance, which is also a really well done movie. But this movie, I think, is actually in some ways more silly than The Substance. I think it's like really over the top and ridiculous in a way that The Substance wasn't. The Substance is like over the top, but it's not trying to be grounded in reality at all, whereas like Revenge is like, this is theoretically something that could happen in real life. And as a result, some of the twists and turns that it takes are a little bit more goofy, in my opinion. But yeah, I overall had a great time with this movie. I think it is worth checking out if you want like a fun time that's like a revenge action thriller type movie. And if you want to see... an amazing directorial voice coming into their own at the start of their hopefully very long and illustrious directing career. And also, if The Substance isn't playing near you and you don't want to wait until the VOD to watch something by Coralie Farjah, check out Revenge. It's available on all streaming services. I think it's available on Shudder as well, if I'm not mistaken, but would check it out. Strongly recommend. All right. Devinder Hardwar, bring us home.
Yeah, two quick recommendations. I want to talk about How to Die Alone, which is the new show starring and created by Natasha Rothwell. She's a comedian from Insecure. She was fantastic in that. She was also in The White Lotus the first season. This is a show about an airport worker who has a near-death experience and basically has a renewed lust for life, or at least the idea that she's going to take more chances and be a little more brave with her life. This is a lot of fun. This is a really fun comedy. I like Natasha Rothwell as well. She was like one of the highlights of Insecure, which is a fantastic show. Everybody should see. And I think this is like dealing with, mid-30s, maybe even late 20s, like malaise about your life and what you're doing and how you can take more control. So on the face of it, I feel like, the description of it is kind of basic, but it's handled really well. I really like the characters. The only downside I'd say is that this show feels weirdly cheap. In that just the production doesn't feel like they can really spend much money beyond occasionally shooting like right on an airport. But a lot of the sets, a lot of the rooms, and when they go to a restaurant or something, it just feels like they just don't have the budget to really let this thing thrive a little bit. And I feel like that does hurt from the enjoyment of the show a little bit. But I'm enjoying it. I just hope like if they continue it, if there are more seasons, I hope they invest more in the show because there's like a lot going on here. Natasha Rothwell is fantastic. She's funny, but will also, make you feel for this character as well. So yeah, good stuff. And also real quick, just wanted to say, I saw the first episode of Uzumaki, which is the new adaptation of the Junji Ito graphic novel, comic series. This one's airing on Adult Swim. I just want to say it's fantastic. So for the people that were avoiding it because they saw some of the other Junji Ito stuff on Netflix, which was not so good, which they were cheaply animated. There was not much like real style to them. This one, at least from what I've seen, captures the like really stark black and white style of Junji Ito and the absolutely horrific imagery from Uzumaki, which if you guys don't know, Uzumaki is a story about a town that is essentially infested with spirals. The idea of spirals, the shape of spirals, and how it can slowly drive people mad. And it's just like really interesting stuff that leads to a lot of body horror, a lot of like cosmic horror almost too. It's fantastic. So this is streaming right now on Max, the one to watch for HBO. It's also airing on Adult Swim. I'd say check it out if you want some more anime.
So Uzumaki Spiral into Horror, I think, right, is the name.
It's the full title, but everybody just calls it Uzumaki. Yeah. It's interesting, this is an Adult Swim production, but with a Japanese animation studio, too.
Yeah, that is interesting. Mm-hmm. Uzumaki Spiral, the Spiral show is on
Maximum Horror.
Spiral into Horror, and then How to Die Alone
is on Hulu.
On Hulu, right. So I just want to mention those things that mm-hmm. Divinger Horror has been watching. That's going to bring us to the end of what we've been watching this week. Let's get to Weekly Plugs. Weekly Plugs, a part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. I want to throw a shout out to my free newsletter, Decoding Everything, at decodingeverything.com, where this last week I published Matt Goldberg's review of Joker Folie à Deux over at decodingeverything.com. The headline of that review, Joker Folie à Deux holds its audience in contempt. Good title for a review. Anyway, check it out, decodingeverything.com. It is a free newsletter that I publish every week. Divinger Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Sure. Check out the latest episode of the Engadget podcast. We talk about the new Windows 11 2024 update, which is not super exciting on its own. But we also talk about how like Microsoft is just so much more excited about AI and Copilot and all that fun stuff. So I'm still not fully sold on those things, but it's interesting to see Microsoft make this twist. So yeah, check out that episode.
Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug.
I do a comedy science podcast called We Have Concerns. It's award-winning. And we won a podcast award for it, and it has been going on quite a long time. One of my favorite things that we do every year is we cover the Ig Nobel Prizes. The Ig Nobel Prize is a delightful tongue-in-cheek award that is really given out every year, but given out to many, many, in many, many categories for science that that is real, that has been published, but is hilarious or weird or unnecessary, and it is a very fun. Our episode covering the Ig Nobel Prizes for 2024 is up on the website now, and it's a great. They're so fun, such wild stuff. Check it out at wehaveconcerns.com.
Want to throw a shout out to the Patreon, patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can sign up for ad-free episodes, exclusive After Darks, and early access to episodes. This week, we're going to be covering It's What's Inside as our review on that show, so look forward to that. Of course, we never want anyone to donate. If it in any way causes them financial hardship, you can always support us for free by going to Apple Podcasts, leaving a review for us, or sharing our videos on YouTube at youtube.com/@thefilmcastpod or on Instagram @thefilmcastpod. We really appreciate everyone who supports the show, spreads the word, and helps to keep it going. Let's get to our review of Joker Folie à Deux.
2 years ago, the name Arthur Fleck hit Gotham like a hurricane.
The trial of the century.
They believe Arthur Fleck to be some kind of martyr. Well, he's not. He's a monster.
When I first saw Joker, when I saw you,
the whole world smiled with you.
For once in my life, I didn't feel so alone anymore.
Welcome to the film cast review of Joker Folie à Deux. I'm going to read the plot summary of this movie from the internet. Struggling with his dual identity, failed comedian Arthur Fleck meets the love of his life, Harley Quinn, while incarcerated at Arkham State Hospital. End quote. So, guys, this movie, Joker Folie à Deux, fascinating release for this movie, because obviously it is a sequel to a wildly successful first film, Joker 1, which came out 5 years ago and grossed almost $1 billion.
I will also say inexplicably successful. Like,
yeah.
Her?
Also, really? 5 years ago? Dollars? Really? My God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
But this one is not doing as well. It had a pretty catastrophic opening at the box office. It made less than half of what the original made. It has a D cinema score, which is worse than Madam Web or Morbius, which are other superhero films that are widely reviled. I think it's going to be a fascinating conversation, which brings me to you, Jeff Cannata. What did you think of Joker Folie à Deux?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say what I thought of Joker Folie à Deux is best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Let's hear it.
Well, boys, Megalopolis is here. The most pretentious film of the year. What could be greater? Well, just 1 week later, Todd Phillips says, please hold my beer.
You're pleased with yourself on that one, huh, Jeff?
It's good.
I am. It's good.
I mean, it's a good, it's well done. It's a good one. It's a good one. Well done.
I am not a fan of this movie. This is a movie about a pack of cigarettes that are smoked in every scene.
Yeah. That's exactly what you should do to your high-level criminals. Give them easy access to cigarettes at all times.
Is that your review? Yeah. Is that the totality of your review?
That's the totality of my review. I think Lady Gaga is incredible and talented and deserves better than this. I loved her in A Star Is Born. I think she should have more acting work and not necessarily just in movies that make her sing. Although obviously she's got pipes and is incredible. There's a moment in this movie, you know, where she's like, she's, you know, Harley Quinn, Harley Quinn, Harley Quinn. And then there's a moment in this movie where she's Lady Gaga. And it's like, we're just not even going to pretend she's not Lady Gaga now. Like, she's at a piano. She's just Lady Gaga. She's just like full Lady Gaga. And I was like, okay, well, at least I get to see that. At least, you know, for 3 minutes, I get some Lady Gaga action. But there is very little, you know, you talk about this movie not being the box office bonanza that the first Joker was. I think that's by design. This movie seems to want to mock you for even appreciating the first movie, which, to be frank, I did not. I hated the first Joker. Somehow this one is even worse. The way I would describe Joker Folie à Deux is 15 minutes of movie in 2 hours. 2 hours, 18 minutes, to be frank.
This could have been a two-part series finale special instead of a two-and-a-half-hour movie.
It very little actually happens.
Yeah.
Very little actually is interesting, and it is stretched out. Obviously, you know, we have these extended musical numbers, which, you know, there is some stylistic novelty to them. And, you know, there is this notion of let's watch Joaquin Phoenix not be able to sing his way through them. And there's a certain sort of rough, counter aesthetic to it that is interesting on a certain level. But, you know, it's sort of anti good, right? That the whole point the whole point is how bad it is, right?
Yeah.
How bad he is at it. And I mean, he's giving it his all. It's like, you know, and I'm not.
Yeah. And Lady Gaga has said in interviews that she had to like train herself to learn how to not sing well, basically, in order to do the musical numbers.
It's a choice, right? I'm not even really criticizing Joaquin Phoenix per se, but, and there's something kind of interesting to that
aesthetic, but you know, the whole idea of a musical as a concept is that the music does advance the story. Mm-hmm. Which
yes.
It almost never does in this movie. There are a few exceptions, but for the most part, it does feel like the movie stops.
Yes, it grinds to a halt.
Yes,
we have this music. For the characters to sing from the Great American Songbook or sing songs that describe their existing emotions in thuddingly obvious fashion, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And it never illuminates anything. It never progresses anything. It never, you know, the idea of a musical is I have to sing this because I can't say it, right? And that's just never the impetus of the songs in this movie.
Right.
It seems to me it really does feel like, okay, now we got to wait for 5 minutes while they sing.
Yeah.
And like I said, the aesthetic of the singing, it's interesting on a certain level, but it's not. There's nothing in this movie that is particularly crowd pleasing or fun. And the idea of like, let's find out what happened after the end of the first Joker. The movie does very little to make that interesting, right? The thrust of what happens in this movie is a trial that is just so mind-numbingly boring, in my opinion. And kind of, It doesn't have much to say, mm-hmm. as so far as I could tell, and doesn't seem to want to even have a commentary on. There's a lot to be mined from taking a hard look at the way we prosecute criminals and the way, you know, the media is involved and the sort of circus around this trial, but like nothing that happens in it bears any resemblance to the way it would really work in real life. And so you're in this kind of weird abstraction anyway, and then the movie further abstracts into musical numbers and just nothing. There's not a single thing in this that worked for me, other than maybe Lady Gaga singing well at a certain point. But it is just, I felt
at
like-
At one moment, yeah.
In one moment, yeah. I really, this is one of my least favorite films of the year, and that's saying a lot.
I'm going to put this out there too. I think, you know, when I came out of this and started posting on threads about my reaction to this movie and on Instagram, and I got some questions about like, what movie's worse, Megalopolis or this? I would much rather watch Megalopolis again.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Right?
100%. And Megalopolis is a failure that is at least watchable and interesting.
Yes. It is an interesting failure. It is an interesting failure.
This is really a slog. Yeah. For me, a true slog of a movie.
Devinder Hardwar, your thoughts on Joker Folie à Deux?
Well, I think looking at the performance of this movie, this is why studios hide musicals, right? I think like once somebody gets a whiff of a musical in your trailer or whatever, a lot of interest just goes away entirely. I don't like this movie. I don't think it's a very good movie. What is interesting, though, is I think there is more going on in this movie than there was in the first Joker. You know, the idea of giving us the sort of aftermath of the first film, the him really confronting the consequences of his actions, seeing how his delusion directly affects real people, like bringing people back from the first movie. Those are all good ideas. But I feel like this movie is full of like ideas without any decent execution, right? Make it sort of a musical. Get Lady Gaga involved. That could be interesting. Lady Gaga's Harley Quinn. You've got something there. Joaquin Phoenix's sort of tortured personality, or him trying to come to terms between his own, you know, his own psyche and his dark shadow. That's interesting. The opening to this movie is almost like a classic WB cartoon. And I was sort of clapping at that because it's like, my God, when are we ever going to see this again? You know, just this idea of opening it like that, not directed by Todd Phillips, by the way. This is that opening was directed by Sylvain Chomet, the director of Triplets Belleville. Mm. So, you know, that it's an interesting
idea. An actual
idea.
Good movie.
An actual good movie, an actual, you know, good artist too. But just like the sort of like what was going on, that was like, it did make me really sad about how, first of all, we will probably never see animation like that on a big screen ever again. just given the rate of the way animation is treated in theaters or in cinema. And also, like, yeah, just so many interesting ideas. I think the trial itself was absolutely boring and outright confounding at times. Not a huge spoiler because this is in the trailer, but also Judge is like, yeah, Joker, you wanna wear your makeup? Sure. I don't see any problem. I don't see how that could harm.
There's the proceedings. Nothing in the rules that say a dog can't play basketball.
My wife and I have a thing where whenever we're watching a legal drama, there's always a moment where the judge says something along the lines of, well, this is highly unusual, but yeah. I'll allow it.
Yeah.
Whenever that happens, you know the movie has jumped the shark. Absolutely.
Yes.
I do want to point out one thing I really enjoyed is that this movie ends up becoming a weird little industry reunion because what's his name? Harry Lauty, who's in industry, plays Harvey Dent. And also Ken Leung, who's his boss in industry, is one of the witnesses.
Right? Yeah,
you know who the casting director is.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, I like these guys. Mm-hmm. They're local. Yeah. They can just like come in for a couple
days. I got my go-to guys. Yeah.
Great. When Ken Leung appears in something, you know, it should be good, or at least he's the highlight of it.
He's great. He's great in the
watch
the movie,
industry. Yeah. Don't watch this movie.
Yeah. Okay. I have a lot of things to say about this movie. I will start by saying that when I came out of the theater, I had deep hatred in my heart for this film. Right? Like when I first emerged, I was like, I am angry that my time has been wasted. I feel like the movie, but here's the thing. The movie is intentionally a provocation, I think, right?
Yes.
The thing that most came to mind was, Alan Moore's depiction of Rorschach in the Watchmen comics, right? Mm. So that's very similar to what Joker is in the first film. Basically, the idea behind Rorschach, I think, and you guys, you know, keep me honest here, but my sense is that's what Batman would really be like in real life, right? Like, if there was a dude
deeply
that was like,
troubled,
he would be like this deeply troubled individual. Yeah. He like puts on this mask. He's all effed up. He's not someone you want to hang out with.
No, journals a lot.
He journals a lot. He's like, he thinks about dark thoughts all the time, you know? Yeah. And basically what Alan Moore in Watchmen is saying, like, hey, like this fantasy you have, like this is what it would be in real life. That's what Joker 1 does. It's like this fantasy you have of like this guy, like Joker. Well, what would that be like in real life? You know, and kind of this movie continues that thought is like, well, yeah, he'd probably go on TV and kill someone. And then there would be this big trial and all this stuff would happen. And
I don't know if I agree with that, but you can continue. I'd like to circle back to that later because I don't think I agree with that, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think what I'm commenting on, Jeff, is like the, theoretically, the first movie is like a very grounded version of the Joker. That's what I'm trying to say.
I agree with
like,
the assessment of the first movie. I'm just saying, I don't think this movie picks up the torch.
That's fair.
Yeah.
So fair enough. I was right for the first half at least.
Yes. Yeah. I agree.
And I think one of the things about, you know, that I've seen people say about the second film, Joker Folie à Deux, is like Todd Phillips didn't like the people who liked the first movie. Like there's I think the first movie is perceived as kind of this incel rallying cry. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
That it's like, oh, there's a lot of people who see themselves in Joker and they're like, oh, he's the guy who's like, people don't treat me well. Society isn't nice to me. And here's a guy who went and actually did something about it. And that's why he's a hero. Right.
Right.
That's why
and
he's a hero.
Yeah. Todd Phillips is saying to those people, you suck. Like, like if you thought that guy was cool in the first film, you actually suck. And this movie is going to take your hero and completely destroy him. That's kind of what this movie does.
And I can get behind that message, but I wish it was more entertaining.
Yeah, there's
that, but also, I don't think Todd Phillips, I think that's part of like what he could not escape from in that first movie, too, is that I think we spend a lot of time just watching Joker dance around in a bathroom. Like, it's like that movie is so obsessed with the iconography and imagery of Joker. And Todd Phillips as a director.
You're saying he made decisions that led to that happening.
Right. Yes, literally made the thing. We've seen what happens to like incel culture rallying behind Heath Ledger's Joker, you know, for a while. Like, and then you make a movie just about that one dude from the guy who brought us, you know, the Hangover movies. Todd Phillips, by the way, like is an interesting artist when it comes to exploring the idea of fragile men. and fragile masculinity. That's something mm-hmm. he's kind of worked with in all of his stuff. So actually, he is a really interesting person to tackle a story like Joker. But I think he did not understand what he was really doing in the first one. Now he's like course correcting.
He doesn't quite
understand that either. Yeah,
he's course correcting. And this is something we've seen a lot of creators do. Like David Chase directing The Sopranos. Like often creators have a really complicated relationship with the characters they create and how they are perceived. And in the case of David Chase and The Sopranos, like everyone loved Tony Soprano. And what David Chase would do as the seasons went on is he would make Tony Soprano do increasingly more and more unforgivable things to be like, hey, FYI, like this is the bad guy.
Yeah.
This is the bad guy, guys. Like, and that's kind of this movie, Joker for Leah, is like Todd Phillips saying, this is the bad guy, FYI. Like, in case you didn't clock it from the first movie, this is the bad guy.
Now, this guy is weak, and this guy is, disturbed, and this guy, there's nothing admirable about him. And in fact, if you admire him, like, isn't it that kind of pathetic of you?
Right,
I think that's the position.
Exactly, which is like definitely a provocation.
Yeah.
I'm going to say this and then we can move on to spoilers, which is a few weeks ago on the podcast, I talked about the new Speak No Evil. And I talked about how the original Speak No Evil film from 2022 was like a movie that, I was very angered by, but then as time went on, you know, I thought of it as like, hey, imagine if you're walking down the street and some guy comes up to you and spits in your mouth and tells you to F yourself and, you know, like messes up your day. Like
that would still, as that would, you know,
as that movie regularly would, occurs, that would still stay, that would still stay in your mind. Cause it's like, at least that's a thing that happened. Joker for Leah Adu is like a guy that comes up to you on the street, spits in your mouth, kicks you in the balls, punches you in the face, and then tells you to go F yourself, elbows you in the ribs, you know, like basically like delivers a haymaker to you. Because say what you will about the tenets of Joker for Leah Adu, it's an ethos. And what I mean by that is somehow Todd Phillips managed to make a movie that angers everyone. Like,
there you go.
If you are a fan of the first movie, this movie does not pay that off. But if you don't like the first movie, you also will be unhappy with this one.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah, that's
true, if you're like, hey, I love musicals, here's an extremely shitty musical for you. Like, we put basically no effort into it. Didn't write
any
new songs.
You like Lady Gaga? Let me waste her in this movie.
Oh, yeah. You like Lady Gaga? Guess what? She's not going to use your skills. too bad.
We will cut out several of her scenes.
Oh, did you like, are you actually like more progressive? You like seeing representation in your movie, in your comic book movies? Guess what? The female characters are garbage in this movie. Right? Like, he made a movie that somehow infuriates both the fans of the first movie and people who didn't like the first movie. And by being angry at it, I'm literally just fulfilling the prophecy. I'm falling into his trap.
The joke was on us all along.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's like, okay, yes, the movie sucks, but like there is something kind of metal about stealing. about
this is what I'm saying. It's kind
about
of
taking 200. The movie's budget cost $200 million. It does not look it.
There's some people who just like to watch the world burn.
He is literally the Heath Ledger Joker setting fire to piles of cash from the first movie.
People were also, there was a tweet going around like, oh, it's so punk that Todd Phillips did this. No, he made a lot of money from the first movie and they gave him free reign to do whatever he want with this one.
Yes. Also,
and
Todd Phillips is anti-union. So like, I don't want to support anything Todd Phillips does.
But like essentially, it is a fuck you to everybody.
It is the Joker scene from The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan's movie, where like he steals all the money and sets it all on fire. It's basically that. And here's the thing. I don't support that. I don't agree with that. I don't enjoy that. But it's a thing. He did a thing.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I agree with you that there's something audacious about making a sequel to a $1 billion movie that it can't help but reject everything about the audience that flocked to that movie.
Yeah. And even the people who disliked it. That's the thing. It's even the people who disliked it are insulted. Yeah.
But like, I don't. It's not like he was like, "Oh, I'm going to swing the other direction."
Right,
and make
he's
a movie.
Just like everyone sucks.
Yeah,
everyone sucks here.
Here's what I will disagree with you though, Dave.
Okay,
I don't think this is the you're walking down the street, they spit in your mouth, kick you in the balls, punch you in the face. I don't think it even has that much impact. I think this is you're walking down the street and a guy somehow talks you into watching a mime show for two hours and 18 minutes. And you're just, why am I here? Like, I wish they would punch me in the face. Just punch me in the face at this point.
I don't know. I don't agree. I think, well, we'll talk about it in spoilers, but I think the way this movie wraps up, I think, is a real F you.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to praise a couple things about the movie before we get to spoilers, and I'll let you talk to Jeff. I actually really like the look of the movie.
Yeah,
I think it's like a beautiful film. I think he has the same cinematographer, right, for both the movies.
Yeah.
And Lawrence Sher is the cinematographer, and it's a gorgeous film.
He's aping a lot of shots from international films, like artistic films, to other musicals. So he is pulling in references here that that people.
And you know what's always pretty when you shoot it? Smoke.
Smoke.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Always pretty.
Think the cast is obviously very good. I think Lady Gaga, for if you don't know, made an entire concept album called Harley Quinn, which is basically her performing the songs from the movie.
It's not bad.
In the voice of Harley Quinn. And it's Lady Gaga at her full powers. So it's like, and
she's
so basically,
awesome.
Hey,
at least we got that.
At least we got that. That's what I'm saying. It's like, at least we got something.
She deserves so much better than this.
Yeah,
she does. She does.
Absolutely. I mean, she got paid, I think, $12 million for this movie. So it's like, okay, well,
she's fine with money. Like,
she's fine with money. But I agree, like, especially after we just saw Joaquin Phoenix walk away from the latest Todd Haynes movie. I mean, Todd Haynes is 63 years old. Like, he doesn't have that many more movies left in him. And for Joaquin Phoenix to basically single-handedly torpedo one of them is pretty awful. And then to see how he's in this movie that wastes the talents of Lady Gaga is doubly
galling. And also wastes his talents too. Like, I think he is doing great work here at times, but I'm like, in service of what? Mm-hmm. What is this really getting us? Like, Joaquin Phoenix doing a really, really interesting take of a guy who's sort of like, disconnected from reality. It is a fascinating performance.
Jeff, I'll give you the last word before we get to spoilers.
Well, I just wanted to say the other thing that I think is fascinating about this movie is that there has never been a superhero movie that is farther from being a superhero movie than this, right?
Yeah.
There's a tenuous at best connection to anything remotely comic book about this. In fact, and you know, we can dig into this more specifically in spoilers, but I kept waiting for the big reveal to be that he's not even the Joker.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I kept waiting for it to be like, ha ha ha, guess what? This was all in this world, there's comic books and he was just aping a comic book that exists and he's not the Joker. He's just a guy who thought that was cool.
We will definitely talk about this in spoilers. Yeah,
we'll talk about it in spoilers. But I just feel like this movie is so, like, that's where when you said, you know, it kind of continues where the last movie left off. I don't think it picks up the torch. I think it eschews any kind of relationship to the universe that was created in the first movie. It just becomes, it's like it's in a different parallel universe all of a sudden.
Mm.
Anyway.
All right. Let's get to spoilers for Joker Folia Deux starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
So many things to talk about. At least a few of which we'll focus on during this conversation. I mean, one of them is, I guess we should just pick up a word Jeff just left off, which is like, there's this whole importance that I personally didn't care at all about like, is it really a separate personality within, you know, Arthur Fleck, or is he actually the guy? And like, I understand that legally the defense of insanity rests on like whether he's like a split personality or not. But apparently this is also extremely important for Harley Quinn and also Joker's fans, which, you know, I don't know why everyone cares that much. But anyway, that's kind of the climax of the movie, is him being like, there is no other Joker. It was just me the whole time. Right. That's kind of how the movie wraps up, which is kind of some version of what you just said, Jeff.
Yeah.
You
know? But also, like, what ultimately ends up happening, I think, like, killing this character off at the very end and then having a deranged criminal start carving his face up, it does set the, you know, this is not in the Nolan universe or anything, but it sets up how, like, this could be an origin story for a Joker who ends up being a mastermind criminal.
An actual Joker who this guy isn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Like this could be like the origin of Heath Ledger's version of the Joker, basically, right?
Right. Yeah. We should talk about that sex scene, which I think is very, very interesting in a movie that is mostly like a waste of our time. Because first of all, how the hell? Yeah, I whatever. I'll do anything to see you. She gets in there. This is not a dream sequence, just from the way everybody talks about it and the way it's like portrayed in the movie. Very interesting. There's like a kink element going on there. She is a fan who is obsessed with him. She doesn't want to screw the real Arthur Fleck. You gotta put the makeup on for this to actually work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it is just, it's very sad. Like, you can imagine this guy's probably a 40-year-old virgin or something. Like, you can imagine this is just like there's a lot going on that scene. And honestly, like, it is, there's nothing erotic about it. It's just like really sad and disturbing. But I'm kind of amazed they even put that in this movie. It's one of those things where it's like Todd Phillips was just like, yeah, I don't care. I don't care what the studio thinks. I don't know.
Yeah, the one interesting take for me of this movie is, flipping the script on Harley Quinn and Joker, right?
Yeah. Because
the entire notion of Harley Quinn is she's just so devoted to him, and he's always commanding her around, and he's the villain and she's the sidekick, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the one interesting thing this movie does is give her all the power, and he is this mealy-mouthed, he's the sidekick. He's you know, and when she realizes that he is just that and not anything grander, she's out.
Yeah. She abandons him, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's really the only interesting thing that the movie does is like put her in the kind of in the driver's seat and make her her decisions be the only, like, he's not making any decisions, you know. He even his like, there was no Joker, it was me the whole time moment just comes out of nowhere. There's no like
okay, that's not entirely true. So there is this very protracted scene where the guards kind of drag him down, yeah, because he's kind of ridiculed them on the stand and humiliated them in some ways. And I've seen a lot of chatter about this online, but what everyone is saying online is that the guards sexually assaulted him, basically, in that scene. And we didn't see it. We see them like tear his clothes off and throw him down, and then it cuts away. But a lot of people are speculating that means he was sexually assaulted by the guards. And we see after that, he like basically loses his will to continue. His acolyte, like the person who was like really a fan of his, is strangled to death by the guards, right? We hear him strangled to death. And the idea is like the combination of these events basically mean like, hey, this whole charade is no longer worth continuing. Like it destroys his spirit and he no longer is able to continue. So there is some kind of, it doesn't come out completely out of nowhere. I'm not saying it's like a satisfying arc or anything. I'm just saying I think the movie does a little bit to make some cause and effect there, is all I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I will say, like, I didn't necessarily conclude that the first time I watched the movie. Like, I was like, oh, it's a very weird cut that happens like right after he's thrown. It's just like there is like 5 minutes of them dragging him down the hallway. They throw him down and then like cut away, and then like there's no, you don't hear any sounds, you don't hear anything. It's just like, so you have to draw your own conclusions. But
I can see that. Yeah. We do want to say Arkham Asylum, probably not the tightest ship over there, huh?
Well, that's always been the case.
I know, but it's like especially hilarious here. It's like, yeah, this guy killed like five people on national television, right? Or at least a lot of people. He can have cigarettes. He can hang out. Let's bring him to the singing class. Let him have a side chat with this girl who's clearly like insane for him. Like all this stuff is just kind of hilarious.
I did think
I like the reveal that she was not even in the asylum. It's like she just
she checked herself.
She's a tourist. Tourist, right?
And that's kind of fun.
And that's my understanding. Like my guess is also that's how she probably got into his cell. Is like she has like a lot of resources, right?
So well, I think that the implication was that she did something to the guards.
That's kind of how I read it. It's like she says like, I will do anything to see you. So
interesting.
You know. Yeah, interesting. No.
We never really find like my interpretation was like, oh, she has so much money. Like maybe her dad owns this place or something, you know, like, but who knows? Again, none of it is stated. But yeah, I do think, really bold move to kill the guy at the end of the movie. I have to say, like, it's just like, oh, you were rooting for this guy. Like he's dying in a rather ignominious fashion here. There's no glory to be found in this death. Right.
Well, I mean, I would love for us to step through the entire last, I don't know, 15 minutes of the movie, that everything from the explosion.
Yeah.
Because that.
And who like set that, the explosion? Like, do we know?
We don't know. I think the implication is that it's just a bunch of fans of his. Yeah, that did
a bunch of fans of his, I think.
Yeah, because I think you think, oh, did Lady Gaga do that?
Right, right.
But I think clearly, no, she didn't.
I will say after like. Not like the movie looks good, but overall, like the entire film has been a very boring slog.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden there is this wonder that is actually incredible.
Yeah.
Where the courthouse explodes and then everything after that is done in one long shot when he gets away, which is amazing. Like, I don't even know how they accomplished it.
It's like, it is amazing, like, but also
Children
sort
of Men level, like you know, style and, you know, filmmaking. But yes.
Yeah. I also think it's kind of bewildering and incoherent as to like so he has the ability to, I feel like it was that entire sequence felt to me like a contrivance where you have Todd Phillips looking at the script going, we got to get him and Harley Quinn back to have a conversation.
Right. They need to have one last conversation.
Yeah. How do we do that?
How do we do
and
that?
It just
let me
feels
rewatch
like all
The
of
Dark
that.
Knight once again. And oh, hole in the building right at the beginning of The Dark Knight. Sure, that's a great idea. Yeah.
you know, you're right. All of a sudden, it's like, okay, now we're talking. Now something's actually happened. What has happened? He stumbles out. You know, these guys approach him, all dressed like him. It's very intense. And you know, I was kind of swept up in that moment of like, okay, well, what's going on? He gets in the car with these guys. They're like, you're the greatest. And then he feels the need to leave them, which I don't kind of understand what's happening there with his inner life and his what and him just sort of like fleeing. I kept waiting for that to be the moment where he like ascends into Jokerdom, but it's the opposite, right? He's fleeing Jokerdom even further.
Yeah.
And then it's all just to get the two of them together to have her crush him. And then it's like, okay, she has crushed him. That's, you know, and then there's this weird like denouement epilogue of actually him dying, which felt so after the fact, and it felt like it stole the power of him dying for me, because we've already seen him stripped of everything that he cared about, because Lady Gaga's like, sorry, bud, peace out. So I just felt like the death was redundant and kind of didn't really even hit me hard, because it's like,
I feel that. Yeah.
You know, anyway, I felt
surprising. Yeah.
I really think the movie makes a lot more sense if every decision is viewed from the perspective of go screw yourself, audience. Like, it's like, I'm going to give you a little bit of action, but like, it's not really going to go anywhere. And then he's going to have this emotional climax. And then after he's at the lowest of the low, emotionally, he's been humbled. He's had everything taken away from him. We're going to kill him.
We're going to go after making all the incels watch, you know, American songs for the past 2 hours as well. Songs that they would not be caught dead living or listening to.
Exactly.
Just like you're you're watching what your parents probably loved or your grandparents loved way back when.
And he has a visitor at the end, and we don't even ever get any clarity as to who that is.
I think that's just to get him out. I think that was the idea.
Well, but I think I felt to me like the guy who kills him is just seizing an opportunity.
Or it could be like the guards like set him up. That was my interpretation, was because he's kind of like alone in that hallway for a really long time.
The guards would love to have him dead, so that is much easier for them. But also, can imagine it could be Catherine Keener's character, who is really on his side, really good lawyer, really good public defender, really putting a lot of faith into him, like at least having some sort of ability to or like not ability to control himself. So I really liked her character. movie didn't really do much with her. Do want to say, you know, Todd Phillips doing the movie like this, it just feels like, I was thinking back to the first Joker. That movie felt like such a weird reflection of what we were living in, which was Donald Trump's America. And I think that's something I couldn't quite escape from. And incel culture, a guy who lives in forever aggrievement, you know, who tried to whip people up and tries to justify the bad things he does because of how the world treats him. And yeah, that's kind of what I was feeling there. I wonder what parallels we can draw from this one. I don't know. But it does feels like we're sick of his shit. So maybe that's the sign for what we'll see in November. Hopefully.
Let's hope. We can hope.
I have seen defenses of this movie and of these movies as like, it's about mental health. It's about the mental health crisis, right? Like, and all these people. And also, like, I notice, excuse me, sir, I notice that you're watching this movie. All you care about is that you're not entertained. You don't really care about Arthur Fleck's mental health, which is the statement the movie's trying to make.
And really, who's thinking, like, about men in our society?
Yeah,
who
will think about the men? I find all those defenses unconvincing. I'm just going to put that out there. I think the first Joker movie is not really about enough to be worth taking seriously.
Agreed.
And this one's about less.
And this one's about less. Yeah.
Yeah.
This one's about less. And so people who are like, don't you see, like, you are reacting exactly like how Todd Phillips is. That's the behavior Todd Phillips is indicting you for. And on some level, I think any reaction to this movie is falling into that trap because the movie is intended to be a provocation.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I don't ascribe any kind of intentionality or purpose to this movie beyond that it's like not a very well-made or entertaining film.
I think he purposefully did want to say screw off. Like, I think that is an intentional choice by him on many, many levels. And if it's good or not,
he got what he wanted. He got what he wanted, which is like everyone hates the movie. Audiences hate the movie. Critics hate the movie. This is one of the few times when the audience score and the critic score are like virtually exactly the same on Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah, and because everyone hates the movie. He made a movie that angered everyone and he intended to do so. And it's like, at the end of the day, Todd Phillips, good job.
I feel like this movie is even less about mental health than the first one was.
Oh, yeah.
And even though this one takes place in a large extent in a mental institution, it is it doesn't care much about that topic, in my opinion.
It's also very pleased with itself, this movie, because it spends most of the movie being like, remember what happened in the first movie? Like, 80% of this movie is, remember what happened in the first movie? Man, that was a good movie, right, guys?
Yeah, that cartoon that Devendra quite rightly praised at the beginning. I thought when we started the movie, I was like, oh, this is great. This is cool.
Yeah,
yeah.
I thought that was one of the neatest, most clever ways to do a previously on that I've seen.
Oh, but don't worry, Jeff, because the movie would then proceed to recap
exactly
the events of the first movie multiple times.
That's right.
For you.
That's right. Yeah. That is exactly right.
Anyway.
It's like, oh, this entire movie is a previously on.
All right. Well, anyway, good job, Todd Phillips. You made everyone angry. You
just
got
like
what
the
you
Seinfeld
want.
Finale.
You got what you wanted. You got what you wanted. Everyone hates it. Good job. Mission accomplished.
Or the Sopranos finale, for that matter.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's true, too.
Disagree. I actually think that finale was good. But
That's a whole other camp. But the idea,
it everybody.
I'm not really joking about the Seinfeld finale thing too, because what a way to like look at the actions of these buffoons that you followed for years.
How dare you have rooted for this guy?
Yes.
How dare you have rooted for this guy? Anyway, I personally have no responsibility in you rooting for the guy. By the way,
wasn't me.
Wasn't me. I didn't do it. Anyway, at the end of the day, it is impressive that Todd Phillips made this movie. That's going to bring us into this week's episode of the Filmcast. You can find more podcasts at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McEwen from The Midnight. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode with video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast, it's going to be Saturday Night. That is the new film by Jason Reitman. Boy, Jeff, I know you've already seen this movie.
Yes.
I watched it yesterday. When I watched it, I was like, Jeff Cannata is going to love this one.
Tune in next week to find out.
Tune in next week to find out. And you can probably tell from that statement whether I liked it or not. But anyway, it should be a fun conversation. Saturday night, the main review for next week's Filmcast. Until then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you later.